Staff members at a museum in Devon, England maintain that the building is haunted by a familiar specter. Situated in a popular seaside town on the county or the country's southeast coast, Torquay Museum is certainly no stranger to the unexplained, having long held a reputation for being haunted. Home to the UK's only collection dedicated to world-famous crime writer Agatha Christie. The museum houses a number of her books as well as unique relics from her childhood in Ashfield. Paranormal activity in the building has often been linked to its association with her, especially given that it's not uncommon for books to fly off the shelves, seemingly on their own accord. Every time books fly off the shelves, it's always Agatha Christie books, said gift shop manager Francesca. It's happened so many times. The most recent was last Tuesday. And you can read more of that story in the news section where our webmaster tonight, Sean Latisore, has posted that and many other tantalizing tidbits. Back to more of my conversation with David Godsword. I tell you, the cryptozoologists are not going to be pleased with this gentleman tonight, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast Toronto, Canada, affiliate In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. And David Godsword is with us, the author of Sun, Sand, and Sea Serpents. David, I was sort of half-joking that the cryptozoologists may not be too pleased listening to this discussion. But let me ask you, in all seriousness, are there sightings of sea creatures, lake monsters that you've documented in the Southeast or maybe just in Florida that you think have some credibility?
Yes, and not just because I'm afraid for my life. If you get rid of all of the distractions, the Clearwater three-toe, the giant octopus in St. Augustine, misidentified manatees, etc., what you seem to have is a consistent creature described in the ocean, not in the rivers, not in the, although possibly in the shallows off the coast, that is between 50 and 100 feet long, swims serpentine, has a head described as being turtle-like, and it's everywhere. It's in the Gulf. It's in the Caribbean. It's off the coast of Florida, all the way up into the Carolinas. And what makes this one interesting is I'm working on the second book in this series, which will cover the rest of the East Coast. And it's also appearing up north. The Gloucester Sea Monster, very famous one from New England.
Ah, that monster's wicked smart.
Wicked smart and wicked big. But it fits this archetype. Now, what makes this odd is that any biologist worth their salt is going to tell you that a warm water creature is not going to live in the cold water as well. And yet, it almost looks like there's an uninterrupted line of these 50 to 100 foot long, dark-colored serpents. Now, whether they are serpents or whether they are eels, that much I don't know yet. But when you get rid of all the other stuff, those I can't explain.
You mentioned the Clearwater three-toed monster.
Yes, a classic, if I might add.
Right, and it has been described also as a giant penguin.
Yes, so, 12-foot-tall penguin.
A 12-foot-tall. All right. So walk us through this legend.
You don't get those tuxedos off the rack. The Clearwater, Florida, it's right next to Dunedin, by the way. I wanted to give you points for pronouncing it correctly before with your Blue Jays.
Yes.
For some reason, down here, they often call it Dunedin. But Clearwater, 1948. Somebody calls the police and says that he was sitting on the beach with his girlfriend and some large sea creature came out. The police jotted down a note and did nothing. 2 days later, people walking on the beach early morning see these giant footprints or tracks coming out of the water. They continue along the beach for several hundred feet and then go back into the water. It's three-toed, bipedal, 14 inches wide, 15 inches long, and the center toe is longer than the outside two. And that was all they saw. Now, the problem with this story is that the police immediately thought it was a hoax, and they pretty much knew who it was right off the bat because there was a professional joker in town. The Clearwater Sun wanted nothing to do with this story. The year before had been the tail end of a red tide outbreak that had pretty much destroyed the economy of the whole Gulf Coast, Clearwater, Dunedin, Tarpon Springs, all up and down.
Red tide, and that's like an algae bloom, is it?
That's an algae bloom that is toxic to fish and people. And when it comes ashore, the fumes are very nasty, so much so that Dunedin and Clearwater had to shut down the schools because they were too close to the water. Tarpon Springs lost the entire sponge industry for that year. So the Clearwater Sun is sitting in there going, we don't need a sea monster right now, thank you very much. So they really downplayed it. So naturally, the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay paper ran with it. And something came out of the water again that night. Now the newspapers are starting to pick up on it, and an Illinois guy named Earl Hayes, and I know that name because I dated whose sister was that name, so it's sort of one of those names that stick in your head for bad reasons. He was out fishing. He says he saw something in the grass flats, which are shallow water with, surprisingly enough, grass growing in them. It was hideous looking, is the description he used. But it sounds very much like what he's describing is a manatee grazing in the grass flats, which is what manatees do. But traffic to the beach started to increase. So suddenly the newspaper's going, well, we may have to do something about this. And they're all running theories. The Sun had one theory that it was alcohol abuse. Another one said it was Dinny the Dinosaur from Alley Oop, which is actually an inside joke because the Alley Oop comic strip artist was a snowbird in Clearwater.
Ah, makes sense. All right.
It's the little things I love. And they just had no idea what the heck it was. So finally, the police say, you know what? We'll keep a closer watch on the beach. So the next sighting is actually up the shoreline in Indian Rocks Beach. So naturally, of course, different set of police, no way to that it was any good. It's almost as if somebody knew. The Indian Rocks Beach report was called in by a fellow named John Moore, which again, is one of these clues that the police knew they were dealing with a prankster already, because John Moore was the name of the ghost that walked Indian Beach at night. So they're going back and forth in the papers. One fellow says he had seen similar footprints down around Morro Castle in Havana, which it turns out he was talking about giant three-toed sloth, which possibly could have still been alive at that point, but so now all of a sudden we've got something walking on the beach with three toes that may or may not be a sloth, may or may not be a dinosaur, may or may not be Alley Oop's best friend. And it goes on back and forth. And as they realize that it's bringing in tourists, there start being reports that are never verified. A local butcher claims that the footprints were all over one of the islands out in the bay, which, of course, nobody could get to in those days. And it just keeps building up. A couple of flyers at a local flying school saw something offshore. And They landed, they got the owner of a restaurant and the owner of the flying school to get on the plane, and they flew over the creature again two or three times. Shape of a log, 10 to 15 feet long, covered in black fur, flippers, hog-like head. That's a manatee again. What makes that one odd is that three of these four guys had been living in Florida enough, long enough to know what a manatee looked like. But all four of them just happened to have a vested interest in making sure the tourism included.
They're not covered in something. But yeah. They're not covered in fur, are they? There's no fur on a manatee, is there?
Well, from a distance. And a manatee is so slow moving, they actually collect algae and moss.
Ah, okay. Makes sense.
So from the keeping in mind an airplane can't fly any lower than 500 feet.
Makes sense. All right.
So, and they should have known a manatee when they saw one.
And all the occupants of this plane have a vested interest in tourist dollars, no doubt.
Oh, yeah. One owns a restaurant on the beach. One owns the flying school, which is also a charter service. One owns the service center that maintains the planes. So, yeah, there's a little bit of a vested interest there.
All right, so the punchline here, the police know who this jokester is, and who is it?
And they can't prove it because they can't catch him. Where it gets kind of complicated is the next set of footprints show up in October of 48, but it's not in Clearwater. It's about 110 miles up the coast and 35 miles upriver in the Suwannee River.
Hmm.
And there they are along the side of the shore, and by sheer dumb luck, and this I actually think was dumb luck, the owner of the property was a fellow named Mark Cheney, who owned the hotel, who owned the restaurant, who owned the gift shop, who owned the shoreline. It was a retired Hollywood publicity guy. And he made some phone calls, and coming down from New York are two well-known naturalists, one of them being Ivan Sanderson.
Ah, there he is again.
There he is again. He's everywhere. Now, the other fellow who came with him was John O'Reilly, who was actually a bigger name in those days. John O'Reilly showed up, looked around, flew back 2 days later, and wrote an article, said, it's a hoax, just like the locals think. Sanderson didn't seem to be convinced at that point, but he also met a local guy named Al Williams who had flown up from Clearwater to see the footprint because he was so interested in them. And Ivan Sanderson, by this point, it seems to be the only one taking them seriously. He goes back to New York and does his radio show, and there's an article in the New York Herald that says, Sanderson says, they're a hoax. So you've got Sanderson saying in 48, point blank, they are a hoax. And that was really the end of it until he goes back to his office and finds this stack of correspondence from witnesses who had seen the monster. And suddenly he's publishing little articles that say, well, it's a monster, it's three-toed, we don't know what it is, it might be a dinosaur. 1951, he's saying it's a dinosaur in a magazine article. And he's reevaluating it in the article. He says, maybe a giant penguin. And he starts saying that the hump and the reports from the Antarctic of a short-necked monster with a staring eyes, there's an undiscovered colony of giant penguins in the Antarctic, and one of them happened to land in Clearwater.
Did he actually believe these creatures were 10, 12 feet tall?
Well, see, there's kind of the problem. He's saying it in print, but nobody knows for sure what he really thought. Ivan Sanderson, with all due respect, wouldn't let facts get in the way of a good story, especially if it was paying by the word.
Gotcha.
Long story short, although we're probably too long for that, the local prankster in Clearwater was a fellow named Al Williams, who ran an automobile repair shop with his partner, Tony Signorini. They were the suspects. Al Williams was famous. And they're just sitting there quietly watching Sanderson. By 1967, he's got books out saying, it's a giant penguin. By that point, they had found fossils of a penguin that grew to be 7 feet tall. So apparently, by Sanderson's logic, if it could reach 7 feet, it could reach 15 feet. They've never found a 15-foot fossil record. But Al Williams died in 70. Sanderson died in 72. And Signorini took over the business, never really gave it much thought until he was older and retiring. And his kids said, you know, you really ought to just tell people. So they contacted a local newspaper person. He pulled the box out from under the bench in the shop. And there they are. A pair of sneakers that had been bolted to a cast iron set of three-toed footprints. And according to Al, was the mastermind. Tony Signorini just put them on and did all the heavy walking. And they would put him in a boat, drop him off at the shore. He'd walk a few feet and then come back into the boat because you couldn't go very far with 30 pounds on each foot. He came out of that. 60 years it took him to discover this. Most of cryptozoology pretty much was not surprised by that point. The International Society of Cryptozoology ran a copy of the article from the Tampa paper, and they admitted it was a hoax, and they kind of blamed Sanderson for letting it go on. And they have this fascinating quote by James Randi, the magician and skeptic.
Yes.
And it says, Sanderson was in the business of writing books about strange subjects, and he would never allow ugly facts to interfere with an otherwise attractive story. In person, he left no question about his doubts. In print, he successfully resisted expressing any serious reservations.
That must have done a lot of damage to the this whole arena of cryptozoology, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and I mean, in this particular case, it wasn't supposed to be a hoax. It was supposed to be a practical joke about dinosaurs walking around. What makes this one fascinating is, first of all, it took him 40-plus years to actually get around to figuring it out, but there are still people who think Tony Signorini, with the shoes and the boots, whose father worked in the foundry so they could cast these things, there are actors claiming that he's the fake. Huh. So in other words, people are saying the hoax isn't the hoax. The hoaxer is being hoaxed.
Some legends die hard. Dave, we'll take another time out. We'll open up the phone lines. Questions and comments for Dave Godsword on Sea Serpents. Say, Elon Musk is bulking up his rocket-building workforce big time. Ars Technica visited the Texas home of SpaceX, where Musk was calling a meeting on a Sunday morning morning at 1 a.m., and there's a lot to unpack here. To start, Musk is worried that our window of opportunity to make it to Mars is closing, so we better hurry up. After the 1 a.m. meeting, SpaceX added over 250 new employees in 2 days, representing a full doubling of the workforce. Ars Technica visited the day after the major Starship prototype implosion that made news earlier this week. The SN1 prototype blew up as a direct result of weak welds. It sounds like everyone involved knew this prototype was faulty and told Musk so when he asked, and he insists it was never designed to fly for real anyway. Where's flex tape when you need it, he reportedly said. It's worrying, though, because SpaceX is designing its factory there to build a Starship every 72 hours, according to Ars Technica. This means its facility in Texas has to include huge windbreaks. Think of the enormous sky-high protective nets at some driving ranges, but solid in order to be able to safely stack these Starships. I think we need probably on the order of 1,000 ships, and each of these ships would have more payload than the Saturn V and be reusable,
according to Elon Musk. Wow, 72 hours he wants to build a starship. You know, I get the feeling when Elon Musk jumps out of bed in the morning and his feet hit the floor, the devil says, oh, darn, he's up. All right. Your questions and comments for David Godsword as we discuss sea serpent legends right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast Toronto, Canada, affiliate In-Depth Radio and News Talk 1010. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. David Godsword is here, and the new book is Sun, Sand, and Sea Serpents. And we talked about sea monsters, but what about the freshwater variety? And I'm thinking about, for example, the St. John's River. There's a creature there. People describe it as looking like some sort of a dragon with a long neck. This is near Jacksonville, Florida. Pinky.
Funny story about Pinky. Pinky has only been seen once for about 20 seconds combined, two separate sightings. And thanks to some awkward wording by one of the authors who compiled sightings from that area, all the sightings in the St. John's River have been grouped together as one creature. The problem is there's a whole bunch of different sightings. There's the Aster monster, which is large, blocky, and gray. And then there is Pinky, who is a single sighting, scrawny, almost skeletal, and dragon-like. You have other monsters up and down. The St. John's is over 300 miles long, and it starts with the swamps near Lake Okeechobee and then travels north. And as it travels north, it goes from being swampy to being a slow-moving river with lakes in it. That's how slow it's moving. And then it takes a hard turn and goes through Jacksonville, where it's brackish. It is a very shallow lake. In fact, it drops no more than 30 feet from its headwaters to its mouth. So there's not a lot of places you can hide something large. Manatees, yes. In fact, there's a manatee haven in there. But Pinky itself somehow managed to get all the good press. So if you look at all the monsters in St. John's, you've got something that's 160, 170 years old, is big and black or big and gray or small and pink or serpentine or blocky. So it gets really confusing. I actually, in this book, separated most of the river from the swamps down south, and because those are a very different sea monster than anything up north. Treasure Coast area, Indian River, St. Lucie River area, they seem to be very large serpents. And when I say large serpents, I mean these are not the current crop of problem snakes we have in the Everglades. These are very distinctly different. They are thicker around, they are wider, and they seem to be able to thrive in both land, freshwater, and brackish water, which almost makes them more similar to the things they're seeing out in the water, out in the ocean. But St. John's, oh, what an amazing collection of stuff they got in there, some of which are probably manatees, some of which are probably serpents, but for some reason, Pinky gets the credit.
All right, let's go to the first-time caller line. Eric is in Lee County, Florida. Eric, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
How are we doing?
Very well, Eric. Go ahead. You're on the line with Dave Godsword.
I want to first say I feel weird even talking about this because I don't talk about it much to anybody. But if I were your listeners, me being one of them, I would take this author very seriously. And that's, I don't know. I don't want to, I'm very prone to getting off on tangents. So I'd rather you ask me questions about the serpent that he talked about.
Well, Eric, it says here on the screen that you worked in the Everglades and you've seen some huge serpents. Why don't you start there and tell us about it?
Well, I have seen petrified footprints of middle toed, three toes, middle one being the longest. I've run heavy equipment down the Everglades doing trail restoration for off-road vehicles, for hunters. We do trail restoration occasionally. I worked for a very large A1 contractor, and please excuse me, I'm a little nervous right now about can't even believe I'm talking
as nervous as I am having to answer the questions.
Yeah, well, I feel like I should say this, is I should say it to someone. Anybody I talk to close to me in the area, they start looking at me like I'm a freak, and it immediately shuts me down. So I just don't talk about it very much to anybody. But I live on a sailboat. I live on the Caloosahatchee River, which is directly connected to the Okeechobee, Lake Okeechobee. And I've seen some things that it makes me very uncomfortable talking about.
Well, you said you're on the Caloosahatchee.
I'm on the Caloosahatchee River. Yes, sir.
That has a history of snakes. And these predate the current.
These are things, when I see these things coming, and I do, and I see them coming, no one else around me seems to see them when I do. I've already looked like a horse's butt too many times.
Well, what have you seen, Eric? Describe what you've seen.
Well, at first sight, I thought they were turtle heads. And this is over the course of first time I saw these things is late 2016. So October of 2016, my girlfriend and I are walking out. I call them Illuminati hotspots. That's what I call them. So let's not get off on that tangent, but that's what they are to me. And so these turtle heads is what I first thought they were, just very large turtles. They are not turtles. They are serpents.
Mm-hmm.
The scales on them are not fish-like. They are snake-like. And they are large. They're as large as my hand. And I'm 5'10", 170 pounds. Got pretty good sized hands. And these scales are as large as my hand. And they are shaped. And I've had many boas. I've had pythons. I've had aquariums. I know the difference between a fish and a serpent. And these scales are the size of my hand. And when I see, now, because my eyes are trained to see these things, I've seen them enough that my eyes are trained to see them. I've pointed them out to people as they go by, and they don't see it because their eyes aren't trained to see it. My eyes are trained to see these things now.
Eric, how long would these things be, these serpents that you've seen? How long, approximately?
I would go closer to 200 feet. Not 100 foot is a baby. And I know this because of the way they behave. You know, you can tell in a human, you can tell when you're observing an adolescent or a toddler or a teenager or an adult, correct?
I suppose, yeah.
Okay, so these things are no different. So when I see one coming, I can tell by the way it moves. They move in S. Just the way you see a desert snake crawl across the sand at high speed, these things move identical to that, but they're in the water.
Like a sidewinder.
Yes.
200 feet.
But not quite like that. But that S shape, not
Got
a
it.
Sidewinder, but more straight forward.
Okay. But 200 feet. David, jump in here. What is that plausible?
It would not be the first time I've heard someone describe a 200-foot snake. And I'm not, again, without actually seeing it myself, I'm not going to argue one way or the other. A lot of these 200-foot tend to end up being two in a row. Is there any chance it was two snakes following each other closely?
Let me think about it. No.
Okay.
He thought long and hard.
Easy?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know what I'm seeing. I know what I'm seeing, and I've been looking at them for years. I know what I'm seeing, and I know when I see one when I see it. I know what I'm talking about.
Eric, what about the girth? How big around? Yeah, how big around would these things be?
Well, that's what I was going to get to. When I see what I am assuming is its middle section, is now passing by me at breakneck speeds.
Mm-hmm.
Breakneck speeds. I mean, it took me, you got to remember, October 2016. We're now 3.5 years later. Three and a half years later. So when I see what I think is this middle section blowing by, and I'm talking about, I mean, moving out. When these things blow by you, they're about 2 foot under the surface, and you can see the sun glistening off of these scales that are the size of my hand. And when they go blowing by, where I think is the midsection is probably about 3 foot in girth.
My Lord. David?
That's that actually, girth-wise at least, matches up with what we're seeing on the Treasure Coast, at least in terms of descriptions. Of course, the problem with the Treasure Coast is these are older sightings, so they're describing them as the thickness of a barrel. You have to sort of do the translation. Now, I do have a question, though. Which part of the river are you in? Are you anywhere near, for instance, the Orange River, where it feeds into the Colusa?
No, I'm born and raised here in Lee County. I'm not sure where the Orange River is. What I will tell you, oh, the Orange River. Let's see. The Orange River is a trickle.
Yes.
That's a trickle. Yeah, that's a trickle of a river.
That's a trickle.
I am about, hey, by the way a crow flies, I'm about 4 miles from Sanibel Island, which is a Illuminati hotspot.
Okay, I know where you are. The reason I'm asking is because back in the turn of the century, the Orange River actually had water in it in those days. And they actually hired a local hunter to go after a, quote, monstrous sea serpent that was in the Orange scaring off the tourists. They don't mind the snakes, but boy, the minute you go after the tourism dollar, that's when all bets are off. But it was the section of the Orange River where it connected to the Caloosahatchee, which goes right down, of course, into the Charlotte Harbor, which is where there's a massive collection of snake sightings over the years.
I'm surprised someone hasn't caught one of these things in a net or with a rod and tackle.
I don't know. I mean, they're not even sure what these snakes are. The circuses tend to have their winter camps on that side of the peninsula, and they tend to lose things every now and then.
Eric, thank you for the call. I want to work Ray in here from Fresno, California. Ray, welcome to Coast AM.
The story was squashed.
Ray, are you there?
Oh, yeah, this is Ray. I'm sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I don't know if you guys heard or if it was ever on your show before about the scuba divers that were attacked off our coast.
The Pensacola Pass plesiosaur.
It was like a dragon head and some body parts of an underwater sea dragon?
Yes, that's, if it's the one I'm thinking of, it's Pensacola.
This was in the 1970s?
Yeah, I believe, because the footage of like the pictures and everything that was, I just randomly checking the web. Were you aware of that, the whole detail of that?
I do. I actually did a lot of work on that one because it's a very odd situation with that one. It's one of the few sea serpent sightings that include fatalities.
Yeah, they squashed it. Like they did a quick story of it, and they squashed it real fast. And then there was a random photographer, right, that just like was a fisherman, like fished about near the mountain. He ran to the authorities, and the random photographer took some pictures of it and evidence, and he still had them, so that's why everybody got to see it online. And yeah, what happened was the two scuba divers were right. They were attacked underwater, and one came back alive, and they went to look for his. And he had found like a scuba gear, and they had a big claw in there. And so they sent an investigation. Our military sent a bunch of dolphins, and they were strapped up with attacking like a strap. Mechanism on their head, and they just tap them to kick off, and it sets off an explosion. And they sent up at least about 15 or a dozen dolphins in there, and they found out where their attack went at. He came out of a cave, and he attacked the dolphins. They attacked each other. Some of the dolphins were killed, but enough dolphins took them out, and probably went back and finished them up because they really destroyed them enough where pieces were found later.
Wow, Ray, this is an amazing story. And Dave, I wish we had time to explore this further. I'm going to have you back on because this is just absolutely remarkable. Ray, thank you for that. Dave, again, Sun, Sand, and Sea Serpents available on pre-order right now, correct?
Correct.
And how do they do that? Amazon?
Amazon is always the easiest way. Or you can go to the publisher's website, which is Anomalous Press. And I had to stop and think about that. That'll get me in trouble.
Amazon
is probably easier to spell, too.
Very good. Dave, a real pleasure. And as I say, we've got to do this again. I'd like to get to the bottom of that Pensacola sea monster.
Anytime. You know how to get hold of me.
Indeed, indeed. David Godsword. All right. When we come back, the Fall Brothers on the secret government alien program with demonic connections. That's coming up next on Coast to Coast AM.